Well, let's start with a word of prayer here, and we'll get into our study. Have a lot to talk about this evening, and so let's go to the Lord in prayer. And Father, we thank you so much for your grace and your goodness and for your guiding hand in our lives, and we thank you for this time together, and may we use the time wisely to glorify you and to hopefully edify one another, and we ask your blessings and guidance in Christ's name. Amen. Well, I wanted to cover a couple of books this evening, and very, very rapidly, John Stuart Mill's book, Utilitarianism, and then we'll spend far more time on the two books by Charles Darwin, The Sin of Man and On the Origin of Species. Does anybody need a copy of the outlines? And hopefully you noticed that I had sent out a revision to those outlines late last night. If you didn't make a note of that, then your outline still correlates pretty closely to what we'll be talking about. Now, I wanted to include John Stuart Mill's book on utilitarianism as one of our 30 worst books of the last 500 years. We could spend a lot of time on this, but frankly, there's much more important things to talk about. And so, unless you have some specific questions, the reason I wanted to include this book in our study, but I always knew we probably wouldn't spend too much time on it, is because Mill is essentially repackaging what in ancient times was referred to as the philosophy of Epicureanism. In other words, this idea that the goal in life is to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. Now, the great philosopher Epicurus, who devised Epicureanism, was smart enough to realize that the goal in life is not just mere physical pleasure, which can lead to total dissipation and a total breakdown of self-discipline and whatever. Epicurus actually taught that the greater pleasures in life were the mental and the moral pleasures. But nonetheless, he was a skeptic. He didn't believe in the gods. And believed that the highest goal in life was individual happiness. And that's essentially what John Stuart Mill will promote in the 19th century. And we know this philosophy that Mill promoted as utilitarianism. He didn't actually invent this philosophy. It was invented by somebody who was closely associated with his father, a man named Jeremy Bentham. But the idea here, as Jeremy Bentham would describe it, was what Bentham called the greatest happiness principle. And for Mill, we can sort of crystallize his, or distill his whole approach to life by one sentence that he wrote in this book, Utilitarianism, in which Mill writes that the end of life is happiness. In other words, the goal of life is individual happiness, okay? So, again, he wasn't necessarily advocating an irresponsible lifestyle or anything like that, but what could be more antithetical to the spirit of the gospel and the spirit of the Christian faith than this idea that the highest value in life is to live for one's own happiness and fulfillment? And so Mill was a secular libertarian. He rejects natural moral law and any kind of objective standard of morality. And in fact, for Mill, the standard of morality is essentially you're free to do anything that you feel like you want to do as long as you don't harm other people. Now, what would you find to be, and that's many people's whole concept of morality today. Anything goes as long as you don't harm somebody else. And many people feel like, wow, you know, that really is what, in essence, that's what morality is all about. But do you see any potential pitfall, any problem with that kind of a mentality? that morality, goodness, is wide open, except, obviously, you don't want to impinge on somebody else's rights or hurt somebody else or whatever. What's the problem with that mentality anyway?
Huh? You can see it real easily in the people that are in jail because of drugs. It doesn't just affect them.
Mm-hmm.
It
affects mm-hmm.
their children,
mm-hmm.
their grandparents, their grandchildren. It affects everybody.
Yeah, oftentimes in our self-centeredness, we don't even realize the impact we're having on someone else. And so again, if this is sort of our guiding principle, just don't abuse somebody else, we can oftentimes cause a great deal of harm to others. Now, what's another fundamental problem with this mentality? Yeah, Bob?
I can think of the influence to other people, even when it's passive.
Uh-huh.
And then also, yeah. You start at a lower level. The lower level usually develops to a higher level that can be dangerous to other people.
Okay, yeah. And even beyond all that is the fact that Mill, who was an atheist, he was a very very ardent atheist. Mill, of course, has no understanding whatsoever of the sacredness of life, and that actually we're here to please and serve and honor, you know, God. And so living on the basis that he advocates, it's very, very easy to ignore, you know, our highest calling. And his philosophy becomes very, very influential. In fact, I would say that this mentality that we can trace again all the way back to ancient Greece is a recurring theme in human history. People want to live their lives on the basis of self-gratification. And again, that doesn't necessarily mean, and certainly John Stuart Mill and even Epicurus would never have endorsed the Hugh Hefner playboy mentality or anything like that, because that obviously is a self-destructive mentality. So they would have never gone that far. But again, it's really living one's life without any concept of pleasing and honoring God. Again, there's much more that we could add to all of this, but you see there at the bottom of the page that it is an anti-Christian philosophy of life, and the utilitarian attraction would be anything that's pleasurable is good. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily just mean pleasurable on the most base level, and anything painful or anything difficult or anything demanding or anything that requires self-discipline is bad. It inhibits our pursuit of pleasure. So, for instance, Christian discipleship, character formation, the principle of self-denial, this is all missing from Mill and his approach to life. And so, for the Christian, a reasonable conclusion would be this: evil does lead to suffering, at least, you know, in many instances, evil leads to suffering. But suffering is not the same thing as evil, and that would be the fundamental fallacy, see, in the mindset of somebody like a John Stuart Mill. Anything that's not pleasurable in life must be bad. And, of course, we know as Christians that's just total nonsense. You know, we're living in a very fallen world, and we are innately very egocentric, self-centered people. So, again, unless you have any specific thoughts or questions, we'll leave John Stuart Mill behind and move on to somebody probably far more important.
But,
yes?
If he says evil creates suffering, what would he claim the basis of evil is? Where does it come from?
Well, I think what you'll find is with people who deny the existence of God or the centrality of God in the human experience, how do people like that even differentiate between good and evil? And for instance, like our speaker coming in a month or so, Melvin Fine. Now, most people, I haven't actually asked Mel this question per se, but most people of that of that persuasion would hold that the goal in life is human fulfillment, human self-actualization, and so on. So what's good is that which contributes to human flourishing. And what's bad is anything that inhibits human flourishing. Okay. Now, that's okay on a superficial level, but the probe beneath that, and why should we even care? In other words, if in fact there is no God, whose very character defines morality, then why should we be concerned one bit with human, other than just our own egoistic impulses and desires? Why should we care about human flourishing? Why should we care about other people? We're only here a few brief years, and then it's over, and we cease to exist as a sentient being. So it's a very, very bleak, nihilistic approach to life. But human flourishing is usually the term that's used by those who deny that we have an ultimate purpose in life, and that is to serve and glorify God. Anything else? All right, well, let's turn our attention then to Charles Darwin. Perhaps you've heard of him. And two books in particular, Origin of Species and The Descent of Man. Now, by way of introduction, Darwin is probably the most important person in this whole list of 30 individuals and books that we are studying during this course. Now, his influence cannot be overstated. And basically, his thesis would go something like this. Life began from non-living matter by way of spontaneous generation, a process that biologists oftentimes refer to as abiogenesis. Okay, abiogenesis, in other words, spontaneous generation. Life begins from non-living matter. Now, some of the most brilliant people in the world, in fact, most of the most brilliant people in the world believe this. And it's just beyond me because of the simple fact that non-living matter, as far as we know, and we've been studying this for over 100 years, non-living matter can't produce living substances for the very simple reason that non-living matter has no potential for life. And yet, in order to try and evade this seemingly obvious conundrum, many who believe in this idea will say, well, it started spontaneously. We just haven't figured it out yet. But going all the way back to the early, and Ray, of course, is a great source on this, going all the way back to the early 1950s, there were attempts to recreate life in the laboratory through chemical processes. And it was all totally artificial, and none of it worked satisfactorily. But when you consider just how dominant Darwinian evolutionary theory is in life today, in our culture today, it's been 75 years since, and scientists have been, again, just continually trying to explain how living material can come from non-living material. And again, it's up to this point a dismal failure, and I think it probably will never be explicable. Yes, that solves the problem. Yeah, we call that panspermia. Life on Earth came from other, galaxies or solar systems or whatever, which does nothing. It just moves the problem back one degree. Even if it were true, it wouldn't explain anything,
Mm-hmm. Really puts that whole thing to rest.
Yeah. It's virtually unimaginable how intelligent, highly educated people can believe this. And yet that's basically the starting point for Darwinian evolutionary theory. So, and by the way, Darwin didn't even try to address that issue. I mean, it was way beyond his area of thought. And but that's where you have to believe, or that's where you have to begin. Now, secondly, a second principle of Darwinism is that the modern tree of life, in other words, all the various species that exist today and so on, are traceable back to common origins. All living things have evolved from a few, or maybe even have evolved from one, single-cell life form that emerged out of the primordial soup in the past. Now, again, that's an interesting theory, but there's absolutely no scientific verification or validation of that. And but according to this idea, see, the transmutation of species occurs over eons of time. And again, you'll have some of these proponents of evolutionary theory make preposterous statements such as, given enough time, the impossible becomes the probable. Now think about that. Given enough time, enough millions and millions of years, the impossible becomes probable. I mean, this is absolute nonsense. See, we ought to require that anybody that goes into the sciences must take an elementary course in logic, you know, in high school or college, and that might, you know, eliminate a lot of this just absurd thinking. Some of our greatest scientists are absolutely clueless when it comes to just basic elementary logic. All right, now let's continue. Human beings are not a special creation of God, but they're the product of naturalistic, random, and purposeless processes. So we're not a special creation of God. We're merely the product of naturalistic processes. In other words, when we use that term naturalistic, we're talking about materialistic processes in which God and any supernatural element is totally missing. And it's random. It's not been designed or programmed. And it's purposeless. So again, that seems to pretty much exclude God altogether from the process. Now, fourthly, human beings are not created in the image of God, but are highly evolved animals. Now, how do we know this? Well, some evolutionary theorists will say, well, just look at body types. This is the argument from homology. In other words, homo, similar body types. And they'll say, you know, we have supposedly a lot in common with certain bipedal animals, apes or chimpanzees or whatever. And that is supposed to basically prove that we have some kind of common ancestry. So, again, we call that homology, and it's based on a fundamental fallacy. And the fundamental fallacy is that common design proves common descent. But again, this doesn't naturally follow, necessarily follow at all. What if common designs that you find among reptiles and amphibians and mammals and, you know, bipedal species such as us, what if these are just, you know, the design model that God used in his creation of various species? The fact that certain animals look alike and have similar skeletal structures and so on doesn't prove anything about common common descent. So again, it's a totally spurious argument. Now, next, just as natural selection and survival of the fittest rule in the animal kingdom, these forces also regulated the ongoing evolution of human beings as well. So natural selection and survival of the fittest. Those that are genetically and physically superior survive and thrive, and they'll be the ones to procreate and pass on their superior genetic structure to those coming after them. So Darwin and the evolutionists would say, yeah, that's how it works in the animal kingdom, and that's how it works in the human animals as well. And then again, we'd want to emphasize that this whole evolutionary process is undirected it's random, and it's purposeless. Now, when Charles Darwin wrote his first book and published it in 1859, Origin of Species, actually that title is a total misnomer, because Darwin never attempted to explain how life began. So the title of the book's The Origin of Species, but he actually doesn't even talk about the origin of species because he didn't have a clue, and frankly, nobody has a clue today. At best, Darwin was merely explaining not the origin of species, but the survival of species, his theory on how species survived, not the arrival of species, but the survival of species. Now, Charles Darwin, again, might be the most important thinker of the last 200 years, well, I'd say probably the last 500 years at least. And of the four most influential apostles of atheism, Darwin, I think, is absolutely the linchpin here, because Darwin provides a facade of scientific respectability that was absolutely indispensable for promoting an atheistic worldview. Now, we've looked at a couple of very significant people up to this point. In philosophy, remember Feuerbach, we talked about several weeks ago. And remember Feuerbach's thesis, and that is that the material world is all that actually is. The material world is the only thing that's real. And you might remember his book, The Essence of Christianity, in which Feuerbach argued that religion is merely a dream of the human soul. In other words, it's really just an illusion that distracts us from what's real, and that is physical material world. So Feuerbach, in philosophy, a very significant force. Now, in the social sciences, as we talked about last week, Karl Marx. Karl Marx is a proponent of what he calls scientific socialism. And he adopts these naturalistic principles, these atheistic principles, to advance a radical atheistic social and political agenda. And you might remember in the Communist Manifesto, Marx dismisses religion, specifically Christianity, as, quote, the opiate of the people. In other words, it's like taking hallucinogenic drugs. It totally distorts reality. And that's Marx's view of religion and Christianity in particular. Then in psychology, and we haven't talked about Freud yet, but in psychology, it's Sigmund Freud. In his book, The Future of an Illusion, Freud essentially likens religious faith to a mental illness or a form of neurosis. Religion, belief in God, is for people who can't face reality, the reality that we just live in a naked, physical, material world. There's nothing else other than what we see. And in another book that he wrote, Civilization and Its Discontents, Freud writes that religion is actually just mass delusion. And in fact, Freud wrote in that particular book, I regard myself as one of the most dangerous enemies of religion. He was, if nothing else, he was a self-promoter, very, very aggressive self-promoter. So I am one of the most dangerous enemies of religion in the world today. So we have those influences, but in the natural sciences, it's Charles Darwin. And Darwin never claimed to be an atheist. In fact, he always claimed that he was merely an agnostic. He was unconvinced that there was a God, not implacably hostile to the existence of God. But his whole belief system rejects the concept of what we call teleology. In other words, the idea that life has any design and purpose and goal. He totally dismisses that altogether. Now, possibly a person could be a Darwinian, well, let's not say Darwin, a person could be an evolutionist and still believe in God, but it would almost have to be a deistic God, maybe a first cause, a God that created everything that exists, but a God that's been absent ever since the creation, and a God who created natural laws by which everything functions, but a God who never intervenes in his creation. So theoretically, you could be a deistic evolutionist. But Darwin doesn't even want to acknowledge that there might actually be a God such as the deists recognized. He's just going to claim to be agnostic. See, now, actually, he was smart enough to realize that no sane person can claim to be an atheist. I mean, that's just ignorant beyond belief, because you can't prove a negative. You can't prove that something doesn't exist. Okay, all you can say is, I don't see sufficient reason to believe, but you can't say it doesn't exist. And so smart skeptics will claim to be agnostics. To be an atheist is exceedingly arrogant. And some of them understand that, and so they don't go that far. It totally discredits them to, you know, be an avowed atheist. Francis Collins, in fact, I heard his name mentioned on television today on Fox News. He's oftentimes held up as sort of the model for Christians who also believe in a form of evolution. And we'll have to have a session sometime where we just focus exclusively on theistic evolution. Millions and millions of Christians claim to be theistic evolutionists, and many of them believe that theistic evolution is perfectly compatible with the Christian faith, but there's serious problems with theistic evolution. It's really not a defensible position as far as I'm concerned. Now, by the way, we ought to say about that, just as a brief departure, very brief. For a Christian to believe anything, well, let's say anything related to science, three criteria have to be met. And it's strange to me that so many Christian thinkers don't see that again, there, we have to meet all three of these criteria. And to believe anything about science, it would have to be philosophically, what should I say, tenable, philosophically, reasonable enough, okay? So, could God have used evolutionary processes to create creatures that eventually became us? Well, yeah, that's absolutely philosophically tenable. If God wanted to use evolution, fine. I have no problem with that at all. But that's only one of three criteria to look at. Secondly, is a particular position biblically supportable without having to torture Scripture, torture early Genesis and the Genesis creation account, twist it all out of shape and form to make it fit your presupposition? Say, so in other words, for a Christian to believe anything, we would have to believe that it's biblically sound, given a high view of Scripture. Now, of course, if you don't have a high view of Scripture, then that opens up lots of possibilities. And then thirdly, is this view scientifically verifiable? And when it comes to the theory of evolution, there's no evidence. There's no evidence. It's merely a theory hanging in, suspended in midair. There's nothing under it there. I mean, it's an interesting theory, but they've never been able to provide any real evidence for their theory. So, again, this just seems so obviously intuitive to me, thinking about things as a Christian. Is it philosophic? Does it make any sense philosophically? Well, evolution could certainly make sense philosophically if that's the way God wanted to do it. That's fine. Is it biblically supportable? Well, you'd have a really hard time correlating evolutionary theory with a high view of the Genesis creation account. And, you know, Ray's written about this in his booklet. And then scientifically verifiable. Well, why should I believe something that for which there is no scientific evidence? It's just, again, theory suspended in midair. But it's, again, very interesting to me that you have Christians who will maybe try to argue on the basis of one or two of these factors, when actually we have to correlate all three. But there is a lot, like Ray implies, there's a lot of misinformation out there. For instance, back in the middle of the 1800s, back in the century of Darwin and all, we were discovering more and more hominid skeletons. And people immediately thought, oh, well, here's a missing link here, see, because these things look kind of like, pretty much like human beings. They're bipedal hominids and all. But that theory has been exploded in recent years because we know genetically they're not linked to human beings. So actually, the more we learn, the more evolutionary theory collapses. And it's been living on borrowed time for a long time, but still there are those that are clinging to it because, frankly, it's about all they've got now as an alternative to believing in God. Okay, but again, the curious thing is for Christians to eagerly embrace evolutionary theory, and I think that's attributed more to psychological factors than anything else. And in the case of some Christians, their job depends on it. You know, their vocation and their job depends on at least paying lip service to evolution. With the publication of Origin of Species, and then a few years later, Darwin's second book, The Descent of Man, Darwin shatters the religious consensus in Europe and America, and his influence is absolutely enormous. Prior to Darwin, most Westerners accepted the biblical account of creation. Most believed, before Darwin, that human beings were actually a special creation of God, and that human beings bore the image of God, the Imago Dei concept. But since Darwin, all of that has collapsed. Here's the Encyclopedia Britannica, 1975, what it says about Darwin. Quote, Darwin did two things. He showed that evolution was in fact contradicting scriptural legends of creation, and that its cause, natural selection, was automatic, leaving no room for divine guidance or design. So, according to Encyclopedia Britannica, which is supposed to be a reputable source, Darwin does two things. He shows that evolution contradicts the legendary accounts, the mythical legendary accounts that we read in Genesis, and that natural selection leaves no room for divine guidance or divine design. Now, again, see, a theistic evolutionist like Francis Collins would take exception to this. Francis Collins would say, and this is a common argument by the theistic evolutionists, and that is, okay, look, to a skeptic, to somebody that doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe in God's active involvement in human affairs, the whole evolutionary process may appear to be random and purposeless, but as believers in God, we believe that it's not random and purposeless. It just appears to be because these people don't see God in anything. So that would be the theistic evolutionist's argument, see. But again, see, even at that, they're on very thin ice. Now, here's a comment from James Eckman. I think this is in your notes. Darwin shook Christianity at its foundation and made atheism respectable. Here's a quote from Ernst Mayr that I really like. He writes, quote, the Darwinian revolution was not merely the replacement of one scientific theory over another, but rather it was the replacement of an entire worldview in which the supernatural was accepted as a normal and relevant explanatory principle by a new worldview in which there was no room whatsoever for supernatural forces. So this is not just a tweaking of our understanding of reality. Darwinian evolutionary theory is the replacement of what in the past had been kind of a generic biblical worldview, supernaturally based worldview, with an entirely new worldview that totally excludes God from the whole process. That's a very important point to keep in mind. We're talking about a total change in people's orientation toward reality, truth and reality. Thomas Huxley, back in the 19th century, Thomas Huxley, another Englishman, was promoted himself as Darwin's bulldog. He was one of Darwin's most vociferous and animated defenders. And Thomas Huxley put it this way, Darwin killed God. Now, by the way, even Thomas Huxley, see, isn't so, pardon the expression, he isn't so stupid as to call himself an atheist. In fact, Thomas Huxley invented the term agnostic. He actually is the inventor of the term. Obviously, there'd been lots of agnostics prior to this time, but Huxley's the one that actually comes up with the term that now so many people, you know, gladly accept. Darwin killed God. Now, that sounds, again, more like an atheist statement than an agnostic statement. And then one of his successors, Sir Julian Huxley, wrote that Darwinism removed the whole idea of God as the creator of organisms from the sphere of rational discussion. So it's not even rational to think in terms of God anymore, according to Julian Huxley. And then, of course, there's the aggressive, self-promoting Richard Dawkins, who has written in recent years, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Is there anything about that statement that strikes you as a bit odd? Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. I think it's a totally illogical statement. How could somebody who believes there's no God, there's no afterlife, there's no meaning and purpose in life, how could somebody like that be intellectually fulfilled? I mean, that's about as bleak and nihilistic a mindset as you can imagine. There is absolutely no reason why we're here. There's no purpose for our being here. Our lives count for nothing. And I find that very, personally, I find that very intellectually fulfilling. And it makes no sense whatsoever, does it? Just like atheism as a worldview is so bleak, so pessimistic, that if you were to follow, if you were to honestly follow your beliefs as an atheist to their logical conclusion, well, you'd either just commit suicide, or actually, there wouldn't even be any reason to commit suicide, because it doesn't matter, does it? So you might say you'd either commit suicide or there'd be no reason to get out of bed in the morning. But then again, if there's no reason for anything, then you might as well get out of bed in the morning and might as well not commit suicide. But Julie?
Yeah, I was just wondering what Darwin's qualifications were. Why would people so accept what he wrote?
Well, there was no such thing in those days as a, quote, scientist. The term scientist is a late 1800s, a late 19th century word. Back then, people called themselves natural philosophers. They understood that science, what we call science, the study of the natural world, is merely a branch of philosophy. And that's to their credit that they understood that. Today, so many scientists will deny that philosophy has anything to do with their beliefs. But in fact, it has everything to do with their beliefs. So again, back then, very few people had academic qualifications. There were a few, and throughout the 1800s, it became more and more common for people to kind of specialize in geology or biology or whatever. But as far as Darwin, let's see, I'm not aware that he had any specific credentials. But back then, people didn't expect scientists to have any specific credentials. Yeah. Bob?
Part of the answer was his books were bestsellers from the get-go. So there was an atmosphere in Europe to want to get rid of God. And they saw that as their savior. I mean, I think they saw in his writings, not the necessarily mm-hmm. the science of it, but, mm-hmm. oh, this is a good excuse to get rid of God. So I think mm-hmm. if it would have been somebody else, they would have been just as popular. It's just mm-hmm. that he was the one mm-hmm. that finally came up with the formula. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't so brilliant. It was they were searching for that. Mm-hmm.
Wanted to believe it. So just as Karl Marx set himself apart from all the other socialist theoreticians by claiming that his understanding of socialism was scientific socialism, as opposed to all the utopian socialistic theories floating around, Darwin claims that he's discovered the scientific key to human development and development of all life forms. Yeah. So there's this facade that it's scientific and therefore it's supposedly credible. His father, by the way, and grandfather, his grandfather actually was one of the first to come up with a theory of evolution. So again, nothing here is original with Charles Darwin. There had been many others before him, including his own grandfather. So he was interested in naturalism, physical issues. Originally, he had considered studying for the ministry in the Anglican Church, but he found that he found theology and biblical studies boring, and frankly, he just wasn't convinced that they were true. But he did have an interest in what we would call, natural sciences. Yeah. Yeah, Bob?
We were discussing tonight before we came that the rumor has been, I took it as fact almost, that a maid or a person who was tending to him towards the end of his life had heard him express sorrow that he led people down his ways. But then other reports said that actually his family said it didn't happen, they never changed his belief. Is that right?
The weight of the evidence argues, I think, pretty decisively that he did not have a deathbed conversion. There's a book called, who is the author? The title of the book is Galileo Goes to Jail and Other Misunderstandings about Science and History. But anyway, the title is Galileo Goes to Jail. And there's a chapter in there about Darwin. Did he have a deathbed confession? And the evidence strongly suggests not so. It makes for a good story, but actually there was a very flamboyant female, I think she was an evangelist, back in the late 1800s, who claimed that he had confessed to her that he'd been wrong, but she was really one of these, that was not a very credible source. Okay. All right, so I think in retrospect, Darwin's theory of evolution is really the connecting link between all these modern heresies. The heresies sparked by people like Feuerbach, like Karl Marx, like Sigmund Freud, but the linchpin of it all is Charles Darwin. Think about it this way. Karl Marx needed Darwin far more than Darwin needed Marx. In fact, Darwin didn't need Marx at all. And likewise, all these others. Apostles of atheism, Charles Darwin provides a pseudo-intellectual, pseudo-scientific basis on which they can go ahead and concoct their humanistic theories. Now, let's talk a little bit about Darwinian theology, because in the first edition of Origin of Species, the last sentence in this book declared that life came from a creator. But in later editions, Darwin deletes that reference to God. He'd become convinced, primarily through people like Thomas Huxley and others, that naturalistic processes alone could account for everything that exists. Okay. Now, interestingly, Darwin's skepticism when it came to belief in God had absolutely nothing to do with science or with his observations of nature. It's very clear. His biographers and all make it very clear that there were two factors that led him away from God. And the first was what we call in theology the theodicy issue. In other words, reconciling the reality of God and the reality of evil and suffering in our world. So, you know, you often hear it phrased this way: if God is great and God is good, why is there so much evil and suffering in the world? In other words, if God is omnipotent, if he's all-powerful and he's also all-loving and benevolent, why does he allow all this suffering in the world? Now, Darwin couldn't reconcile belief in an all-powerful and benevolent God with the reality of evil and suffering. And in particular, see, he couldn't reconcile the reality of a good and just God with the agonizing death of his little 10-year-old daughter, Annie, who apparently went through months and months of just intense suffering. And so Darwin apparently grows very, very bitter and blames God for his daughter's death. And, of course, the ultimate insult, if you were angry toward God, the ultimate insult would be to claim that you don't even believe there is a God. Okay, that puts him in his place. Okay, so the theodicy issue. Then secondarily, he was very offended by the traditional Christian doctrine of hell. Again, this idea, why would a good and loving and just God send people to hell for all of eternity who were good people just because they didn't happen to be Christians? And in particular, see, he has in mind his agnostic, free-thinking father and grandfather and brother. And so regarding this doctrine, this traditional Christian doctrine of hell, Darwin calls it a, quote, damnable doctrine. So it's these two issues, the theodicy issue and the reality of hell, that turn him away from the Christian faith, and he wants nothing to do with it. Now, he eventually rejects Christianity and will define himself, as we said, as an agnostic. He'll go on to say that he can't believe in the miracles that are recorded in the Bible. And he says, quote, the more we know about the fixed laws of nature, the more incredible miracles become. So this is a growing trend over the last 200 years or so on, and that is this idea that the more we understand about the laws of nature, how the world and the universe work, what we used to attribute to God and direct divine intervention, we now can explain naturalistically. For instance, every time it rains, you know, we don't say, well, that's, you know, that's God doing it directly. Earthquakes and natural disasters and things like that. So as our knowledge and understanding of the physical world mushrooms, it seems to be pushing God further and further out on the periphery. See, the more we can explain naturalistically, the less reason there is to believe in God. And the 19th century and 20th century, of course, that same, you know, our knowledge and understanding of the physical world was just, you know, increasing exponentially during those centuries. And so in the minds of many people, there's less and less and less reason to believe in God. You know, eventually we'll figure out how everything works. We'll come up with a theory of everything, as Stephen Hawking, his theory of everything. And then we'll be able to explain naturalistically all the mysteries of life, which means there won't be any reason to believe in God at that point. So I can understand how people would buy into that. Now, in the last 25 years, though, there's been a phenomenal revolution take place in scientific knowledge and understanding with the advent of intelligent design theory. And intelligent design theory basically reverses that expansion. And now, as we learn even more about the intricacies of the universe, it actually draws our attention back to the fact that there has to be a divine mind, an intelligent designer behind the mysteries of the physical material world. Now, prior to 25 years ago, with the advent of intelligent design, there still wasn't adequate reason for Christians, obviously, to buy into that, you know, more agnostic view. But certainly in the last 25... Now, if you really want to offend and irritate a skeptic or a liberal, a Christian liberal, merely point out to them that they are just hopelessly behind the times. Anything they believe is at least 25 years out of date. And this is a point we ought to really emphasize in our apologetics. These people are totally behind the times, including all these theistic evolutionists, all these Christians who also buy into evolutionary theory. They are so out of date, it's pathetic, and we would do them a great benefit if we would point that out to them. All right, so Darwin describes himself as an agnostic. He appears not to have been a hardcore atheist. He confessed to having, quote, an inward conviction that, quote, this beautiful universe was not the result of chance alone. So he has this doubt. And in a letter to Asa Gray, probably America's most renowned natural philosopher, a great professor at Harvard, and Asa Gray actually eagerly accepted Darwin's new theory, and they became very close friends. And in fact, Asa Gray became Darwin's foremost promoter of his book here in America. And like I said, Asa Gray, a very renowned, highly respected natural philosopher at Harvard. And in a letter to Asa Gray in 1860, as they were going back and forth kind of discussing Darwin's book, Darwin even conceded that living organisms might be the result of designed laws with the details, he said, left to chance. In other words, he says, well, theoretically, God might have, you might say, programmed it, and then he just left it to chance, to natural, you know, naturalistic chance. So here, Darwin is coming very close to the position of the theistic evolutionists. But again, see, at this point in his life, at the very best, he would have been a deistic evolutionist. But as he wrote to Asa Gray, it seems to me absurd to doubt that a man may be an ardent theist and an evolutionist. So Darwin is making it very clear that he doesn't really believe in God, or at least he doesn't find sufficient evidence. But he's saying, you know, you could still be a theist and still believe in evolution. And in fact, it's interesting, Asa Gray tried to convince Darwin that, in fact, Darwin was a theistic evolutionist. And Darwin keeps saying, no, I'm not. but Gray, who was a professing Christian, wanted so badly for Darwin to be a theistic evolutionist. But Darwin always held him off. Okay? Any comments, questions before we move on?
One thing Darwin did say, that if anyone could demonstrate that given enough time, that small organism could not develop into a higher form, then that would undermine everything he'd ever taught.
That's right.
And furthermore, see, he comes along at a time when naturalists are just beginning to discover all these amazing fossils. And that have been buried for, you know, umpteen centuries. And so Darwin assumes that as time goes on, there will be all these missing links, fossils of all these missing links will be discovered. And so eventually we'll have a very clear record of all the life forms that eventually led to human beings. And of course, he's absolutely wrong. None of it's forthcoming. Well, as I said a while ago, Darwin wasn't the first to theorize that human beings had descended from lower life forms. In fact, you can go back into ancient Greece, and there was an ancient theory of evolution among ancient Greek philosophers. And like I said, half a century before Darwin wrote, his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, speculated that all species, including human beings, transformed over time. So again, this is an interesting thing to contemplate, because if you buy into the evolutionary model, see, we're just a transitional species. And, 50,000 years from now or 100,000 years from now, there won't be creatures like us. they'll have moved on. So we're merely a transitional life form. There were others as well that had put forth theories somewhat similar. And as I said, Darwin's foremost cheerleader and promoter was Thomas Huxley. Several years before Darwin wrote his book, The Descent of Man, in which he speculates about human evolution, Thomas Huxley had published a book called Evidence as to Man's Place in Nature, in which Huxley argued that humanity had evolved from apes. And in the frontispiece of his book, it features these famous drawings that Huxley had made comparing the skeletons of apes and humans. Again, it's based on this questionable theory of homology. Because we share some similar body types and features, we must all be descended. Common design means common descent. But again, as we've said, that doesn't naturally follow. Anyway, Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, and he'll be a very aggressive promoter of Darwinian theory. And for time's sake, we'll kind of move on here. Now, on the back of the page there, on page 16 of your outline, let's take a look for a few minutes here at social Darwinism. And Darwin's theories, of course, emerge at a time in Western history when you have these modern progressive societies like Western Europe, Great Britain, the United States, and so on, that are transitioning from being rural agricultural societies with rural-based economies into very sophisticated technology-based urban industrial societies and economies. Now, because fewer people are on the farms producing food that the rest of us consume, in 1798, there was a well-known English cleric and scholar by the name of Robert Malthus, or Robert Thomas Malthus, and he published a book called An Essay on the Principle of Population, and many of you are familiar with Malthus and his theory, Malthusian theory, in which he argued that unless population growth was controlled, it would inevitably exceed our ability to produce enough food. In other words, his argument was essentially that population begins to increase geometrically in a society, but food production only increases arithmetically. So at a certain point, there's going to be too many of us and not enough food. And so based on that, Malthus said we need to be a little more cautious in terms of the number and the quality of human beings that we're turning out. And in particular, he believed that government-sponsored welfare programs for the poor and for the physically and mentally impaired, these kind of programs are counterproductive because, as Malthus would argue, all these programs do, these social welfare programs do, is sustain the very weakest and the least productive and the less fit people in society. And there were others that chimed in, such as the Scottish Presbyterian minister Thomas Chalmers, who called for the elimination of public-funded welfare relief. And he said that when it comes to helping people that are destitute and needy, we need to draw a very definite line between what he called the deserving and the undeserving poor. And the deserving poor are people who legitimately are victims of unfortunate circumstances in life. And there's always people like that. But he would argue that most of the poor people are poor because of character defects. And those are people he would call the undeserving poor. They have bad habits, lack of self-discipline, and so on. And people like that, we have absolutely no obligation to help. And so the deserving and the undeserving poor. Now, by the way, from the time of Chalmers, and this would be, again, in the 1830s and 40s, up to the 1960s, that idea of the deserving versus the undeserving poor, that was considered just common sense. But here in the United States in the 1960s, under Lyndon Johnson, that distinction between the deserving and the undeserving poor was totally eliminated. And it was thought to be too intolerant, too judgmental to try and discriminate between the deserving and the undeserving poor. So that was part of Johnson and his party's whole agenda. And that's what's, that mentality has carried through to the present day as well. What was it, a year or two ago? Wasn't it Florida that wanted to test welfare recipients for drug abuse? And that was struck down by federal courts. You can't even discriminate when it comes to people that are drug abusers. They're still entitled to social welfare. In other words, our tax dollars at work. So anyway, Chalmers is the first one to put forth that idea. Now, especially in America, many successful and influential businessmen and civic leaders were quite contemptuous of the poor. For instance, the founder of Temple University in Philadelphia, Russell Conwell, put it this way. He writes, quote, "I sympathize with the poor, but the number of the poor who are to be sympathized with is actually very small. To sympathize with a man whom God has punished for his sins is to do wrong. Let us remember there is not a poor person in the United States who was not made poor by his own shortcomings." So this is somebody who's essentially arguing, hey, they're all undeserving. there are no unfortunate, innocent victims, of circumstances. Now, this comes in the context in which a lot of Westerners and especially Americans are enthusiastically promoting the concepts that we associate with laissez-faire capitalism. In fact, many considered laissez-faire capitalism to be sacrosanct, and I'm sure you're familiar with that term, laissez-faire capitalism. It essentially means absolutely no government regulations, controls, or anything. Just let the market sort everything out for itself. Now, in England at this time, Herbert Spencer, who was one of Darwin's closest allies, tries to apply Darwinian theories to human society in general. And in a book he writes in 1864, Spencer argues that human societies and institutions pass through the process of natural selection, which results in the survival of the fittest. So Herbert Spencer's arguing that, look, this principle, this Darwinian principle, doesn't just apply to biological formation. It applies to human societies as well. And to justify laissez-faire capitalism and intense cutthroat competition, business leaders would oftentimes adopt the principles of social Darwinism to the business world itself. For instance, John D. Rockefeller, very staunch Baptist his whole life, howbeit a liberal Baptist, theologically he was fairly liberal, but a lifelong Sunday school teacher. And John D. Rockefeller will tell his Sunday school class, quote, "The growth of large businesses, or monopolies, is merely a matter of the survival of the fittest." And he goes on to say, "This is not an evil tendency in business. It's merely the working out of the laws of nature and the laws of God." So he's saying, the same way it works in the field, in the animal kingdom, survival of the fittest, it also works that way in our political economy and social economy as well. Now, this sounds like a sensible and maybe even a socially beneficial idea. In fact, it was socially beneficial in many respects. But it's also very, very contrary to natural law principles, natural moral law principles of social justice and the general welfare of society. And again, I use that term social justice not in the popular left-wing usage, cultural Marxist usage, but social justice as it's promoted so aggressively in among the Old Testament prophets and to some extent in the New Testament as well. Now, it was thought, that ruthless competition in the business world and in society was just, again, the way things operate. That's the law of the jungle. It works that way in the animal kingdom. It should work that way in all of our human relations as well. And so without spending undue time on this particular section, let's move on and take a look at social Darwinism and its implications when it comes to racism and eugenics. Now, Darwinists are, of course, loath to admit it, but the social and the economic and the political ramifications of Darwinism are really unavoidable. If you've bothered to look at the full title of Darwin's first book, which we oftentimes call The Origin of Species, well, look at the full title, and the title is actually On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Favored races. See, when Darwin writes this book, he avoids including human beings in his evolutionary theory because his theories were already controversial enough and he didn't want to just totally ruin his career. But the implications of his theory were clear enough, and that is that human beings, like all the rest of animals, are not a special category of life form, nor are human beings above the process of natural selection and survival of the fittest. Now, from the time of Darwin, his theories were used to promote racism. If natural selection and survival of the fittest, say, are the, quote, laws that govern nature, and if human beings are merely highly evolved animals, then inevitably the superior races will subjugate and maybe even eliminate the inferior races. And he actually comes very close to stating this explicitly. In his book, The Descent of Man, he elaborates on this theory of racial superiority. And this is how Darwin puts it. As many more individuals of each species are born than can possibly survive, and as consequently there is a frequently recurring struggle for existence, it follows that any being, if it varies however slightly in any manner profitable to itself, under the complex and sometimes varying conditions of life, will have a better chance of surviving and thus be naturally selected. And then he goes on to say that at some future period, not very distant, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races around the world. And then he says, the break between man and his nearest allies will then be wider, for it will intervene between man in a more civilized state, as we may hope, even that of the Caucasian, and some ape as low as a baboon, instead of, as now, between the Caucasian, who is the superior, and the Negro, or the Australian, the Aborigine, or the gorilla. So he's saying that if we just let nature play out, eventually the superior races will dominate as well, and there's no question in his mind who the superior race is. It's his race. And so he's saying, you know, that eventually the inferior races will cease to exist, and then the gap between us superior people and our nearest rival will be even wider than it presently is. Today, the gap is between the Caucasians and the Negroes, to use his terminology, but then it'll be between the Caucasians, who are even more developed at this point, and the baboons, okay? Now, according to Darwin, he actually measures the skull capacities of the various races. And again, no surprise, he comes up with the startling conclusion that the average European skull is much larger, and apparently that means that we're more evolved and more, you know, intelligent than the Asian skull. Sorry about that, Jay. And the Asian skull is more highly developed than the Negro skull, and so on. So now this is, you know, this word racism's thrown all over the place these days, and usually it's just, totally inappropriate the way the word is used. A racist is somebody who actually believes that some races are genetically superior to others. So by any clear definition, Charles Darwin is a racist. He actually believes in superiority of some races. Now, according to Darwinian theory, this competition between races is not immoral. It's just, again, the law of the jungle. And in fact, it's natural. And there is no right or wrong about it, in which case, see, traditional Christian morality and ethics, including the defense of the poor and the oppressed and the needy, actually interferes in the evolutionary process. So traditional Christian morality is actually impeding the process of natural selection and survival of the fittest. So again, innately, see, this is a very immoral doctrine that the Darwin is putting forth. Now, another logical deduction of Darwinism is that his theories can be used to justify eugenics. Now, Darwin would never go so far as to say certain races or certain people ought to be killed. But he did believe, and he was very overt about this, that certain inferior people shouldn't be allowed to procreate. Okay. And Benjamin Weicker writes in his biography of Darwin, if everything Darwin wrote is true, then it quite logically follows that human beings ought to ensure that the fit breed with abandon and that the unfit are weeded out. Attempts to disengage Darwin from the eugenics movement date from after World War II, after Hitler gave a bad name to the survival of the fittest as applied to human beings. But it's impossible to distance Darwin from eugenics. See, prior to World War II and the way the Nazis used eugenics, there were a lot of people who were totally on board. You know, the founder of Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger, was very, very strongly in support of the eugenics movement. But it was thought that Hitler went too far and he gave a bad name to the idea of eugenics. But Darwin's very much on board, and in fact, he promotes the idea, as do many social scientists in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And Darwin's very, very clear about this. He says, you know, the worst in our society marry earlier and produce more children than responsible people do. Responsible people wait until later in life to get married, so that they can provide for their family, whereas the worst people are just very impulse driven, and so if we allow this to continue on without checks, the whole human race is going to be degraded. So certainly, those who understood Darwinism the best drew this connection between his theory and eugenics. And eugenics in no way was a policy that was originated by the Nazis. And although during World War II, Hitler did make comments such as he vowed to reverse what he called centuries of mistaken humanitarianism. So in Hitler's mind, remember, he's cleansing the human race of the inferior elements. And why have these inferior elements been allowed to exist for all these centuries? Well, it's because of Christianity, which considers life sacred. And Christians have supported and continued to help the most unfit people in society. Unfit, you know, again, according to Hitler's idea. So let's close on this note, and that is that Darwinism is absolutely, totally removed from morality. There is absolutely no basis for morality in this belief system. Nature and natural processes are all that matter, and nature doesn't have a moral nature. Nature just is, okay? It's totally amoral. So for Darwin, what we call morality is really just part of our survival strategy. In other words, why is it that we refrain ourselves from abusing and injuring and killing other people who get in our way or who we just don't like? Why is it that we don't just eliminate people that irritate us? Well, it's not because it would be wrong to eliminate them. It's merely for our own self-preservation because we wouldn't want somebody else doing it to ourselves. And that's about as far as you get in terms of moral thinking with Darwinism or any kind of naturalistic approach like Darwinism. So morality is merely a practical tactic. It's not a divinely ordained law. It's just what we need to survive. So in other words, it takes us back to this idea of human flourishing. The reason we put, you know, restrictions on how we treat other people is because personally we want to flourish, and we're afraid if we offend people unnecessarily, you know, they're going to impinge upon our freedom as well. So despite his notoriety, Darwin seems to have been, in the end, an unconvinced Darwinist. See, he was never actually sure if he could even trust his own convictions. And he admits it. He writes, "The horrid doubt always arises in my mind whether the convictions of my mind, which have been developed from the mind of lower animals, are of any value or are trustworthy." So let me read that again. He says, you know, in unguarded moments, I have this unsettling suspicion that what I believe, what I think, the convictions of my mind, well, they've only been developed from the minds of lower animals. And so can I even trust the convictions of my own mind? Are they even valuable, and are they even trustworthy? See, and in that sense, he did lurch uncontrollably into the truth. And that would be, you know, an example of Darwin's doubt. And that is, if we're merely products of naturalistic forces, if there is no moral divine involvement in our makeup, how can we even think that we're in touch with reality or that our thinking has any validity whatsoever? Do we put a lot of value in the thinking of zebras or cockroaches or, you know, anything like that? Would you trust, you know, the moral reasoning capacity of a baboon? And if not, why should we really trust our own reasoning capacity? So it's really a self-defeating philosophy, and this shouldn't be surprising because it's not the truth. There's a lot of lies built into this belief system. And like all belief systems that are not true, there's going to be contradictions in them. So with that, let me just briefly comments, questions? Yeah, that's because public education is so tolerant. That's why we can't get into it and express our views. You know, a lot of Christian schools teach theistic evolution. I believe Wheaton, that's the official position of Wheaton, if I'm not mistaken, which is, you know, always been a great evangelical college. And so theistic evolution is certainly dominant among perhaps most, I don't know if it's most Christians, but certainly it's very dominant. As you say, I mean, it's dominant for no good reason. It's dominant for no good reason. But, of course, whether you're a Christian historian or a Christian psychologist or a Christian biologist, the tendency is to want to be well accepted among your peers, your colleagues, you know. And I think that's the psychological component. And sometimes careers depend upon the opinions of your colleagues. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, most all these English evangelicals theistic evolutionists. You know, people who we would admire and respect a great deal, like Alistair McGrath and people like that, they're theistic evolutionists. You know, I challenge them to meet these three criteria. You know, you got to compromise on at least one, if not two, of these areas in order to become an avowed theistic evolutionist. But it's sort of the easy, and I'm not criticizing anybody in particular, but it's the easy path for Christians to take. Mm-hmm. And again, this is their argument in a nutshell. What appears to secular scientists to be random, purposeless, and naturalistic is not actually random, purposeless, and naturalistic. In fact, God programmed the whole evolutionary process, and so he's been involved in it from the very beginning. See, that's their argument. And, you know, it would be a plausible argument, again, if there were any scientific evidence, if it corresponded to a high view of Scripture, which is, I don't think it possibly can. It does meet this criterion, but there's two others that it fails. So it doesn't work just to say, oh, well, this is the means that God used to create human beings. Again, that's a fine theory philosophically, but it fails on every other level. It's just too easy. Bob?
You know, without the teaching of deity and man being in God's image, many of us in the South, when we were children, actually considered the black race, for instance, we never stated it or defined it, but considered them less than the white race
for
the lack of teaching of what man is.
Oh, there were even Christians who believed in the theory of polygyny, and that is that the various races were created at a different time in history by God. So the superior races, you know, had been on Earth longer than the inferior races, you know. So we call that polygyny, just crackpot theory that some people believed in. Well, you know, where can you even discuss these matters? Because, Jay, in a lot of Christian schools, whether they're high schools or colleges, theistic evolution is the default position. And so where can Christians go? I don't know of any place Christians can go for education on this matter other than the church. But when the church ceases to become a center for quality education, there's no place else, is there? We keep coming back to that quote by the Yale church historian Yaroslav Pelikan, where he says, the church should always be more than a school. I mean, anybody knows that. The church doesn't exist just to educate people. But the church should never be less than a school. But that's exactly what the church is in probably 98% of our churches here in America. No quality education goes on whatsoever. I mean, there are big mega churches that you're probably aware of. There's no education component whatsoever. Well, listen, nice being with you this evening. Hope that was informative. And so we'll move on next week and take a look at a couple of other despicable people and their famous books.